Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are advised to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, as the court resumes oral arguments for the 2001-2002 term, we have three matters set for submission. In the order of their presentation, they are Texas Natural Resource Conservation Commission versus I.T. Davy from Travis County, BMC Software Belgium NV versus Mikhail Marquand from Harris County, and D. Houston Incorporated Doing Businesses Treasures versus Melissa Love, also from Harris County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by visiting with the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and complete the arguments by noon. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee from the clerk of the court. We are pleased to welcome to the hearing today a very special guest, Mr. Xavier Rodriguez of the San Antonio Bar, who will be up on the bench by oral arguments next week. Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in TNRCC versus I.T. Davy.
May it please the court, Mr. Thompson will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Earlier this year in Little Texas, this court rejected the waiver by conduct doctrine and reaffirmed the state's immunity from suit in breach of contract cases absent special statutory or legislative consent. This court stated that there is but one route to the courthouse for breach of contract claims against the
state. But we did that because of the statutory scheme, and hasn't that now been amended so it doesn't apply to this contract?
It doesn't apply to this contract, Your Honor.
So doesn't that throw us right back to addressing the waiver by conduct exception?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because you didn't defer to the legislature simply because the Little Tex, Dow, Macker, Air, Airtron contracts would have fallen within Chapter 2260. You deferred to the legislature because the legislature addressed the problem, weighed the policy decisions, and came up with a comprehensive administrative scheme for addressing breach of contract claims against the state. Whether a particular claim falls within the provisions of Chapter 2260 should not matter.
Why not? If the basis for our reasoning in the Little Tex case was the fact that the legislature had devised an administrative scheme to settle breach of contract disputes, and if that scheme is not applicable, then we don't have legislative action in the area as to this contract.
Not as to this contract, Your Honor. But it's just like when the court enacted the Tort Claims Act. Some claims fall within the Act, some claims fall outside the Act, but the legislature has still acted. In this case, it's the same thing. The administrative scheme is still in place. The legislature.
It's only in place from a certain date forward, from the end of August 1999, to contracts entered into from the end of August 1999 forward. So contracts before that date are actually outside the scheme and would predate any legislative action.
And for those contracts, Your Honor, they need to go to the legislature under Chapter 107. They simply exempted them from previously going to Chapter 2260. It's just as if these contract claims existed beforehand and didn't have the benefit of Chapter 2260. It is the state's position that those contracting parties were required to go to the legislature to seek permission.
You will at least concede this is an open question based on language in some of our earlier cases.
Your Honor, the court had not addressed it. However, in the Little Tex case, this court said, in light of the administrative scheme that the legislature has enacted, the court would not recognize a waiver by conduct exception. It did not say simply because these two contracts fall within Chapter
20. Well, assume that we disagree with your interpretation of Little Tex and that we believe we need to revisit the waiver by conduct exception. Why shouldn't we recognize the waiver by conduct exception with respect to this contract?
For the same reasons you've had before, Your Honor. We believe the legislature is the appropriate body to weigh these policy decisions. They have done so. even when they enacted 2260, they didn't include all contracts. They only included written contracts for goods, services, and construction. There were going to be contracts that fell outside the scope of those provisions.
Well, then as to those contracts that are outside the scope of the provisions, for one reason or another, why should we not recognize the waiver by conduct exception when the doctrine of immunity was in the first instance a judicially created doctrine?
Your Honor, we believe that the court has historically always deferred to the legislature to waive that immunity and should continue to do so.
Okay, well,
I thought we
put
set
aside.
Up the immunity. Go ahead.
Well, what I'm trying to get you to talk to me about is let's put all of that aside and give me good policy reasons. Assume with us that we're really going to look at that issue. I would like to know what the state's position is as to why it would be good public policy for us not to adopt the waiver by performance.
Your Honor, we believe it would be better to allow the legislature to craft that scheme. They can appropriately weigh the policy decisions. We don't think
okay.
the court
well,
should be
I, just, I know, but I understand that that's your position, but I would just like to know the state's position then about why it's not good policy for that doctrine to apply. Just plain old good public policy, whoever gets to decide, if legislature or this court.
Your Honor, we don't think courts should decide on a case-by-case basis whether equitable circumstances warrant the judicial waiver by conduct. We think instead that there should be a rule established by the legislature.
Okay, so you're not going to answer my question then in terms of, or else I'm not communicating it very well. I understand that you think we should defer to the legislature.
Yes, Your Honor.
I've gotten that. But my question to you is that assume with me that we don't. And we are squarely going to decide whether that waiver by conduct exception should be part of Texas law related to immunity. Why would it not be good policy for us to adopt that doctrine? Just as a matter of public policy.
Your Honor, we simply do not think it's for this court to waive.
What argument would you make to the legislature?
Your Honor, we would say that it is the same public fisc arguments that are always made in support of immunity from suit, Your Honor, and that certain claims should fall within and certain claims should not fall within a waiver of immunity for the state.
Isn't there some danger if the state never has an obligation to pay that goods and services are going to become more expensive, that there'll just be a built-in insurance policy? The public fisc will suffer from private contractors not having any avenue of enforcement?
If we assume that the state flagrantly breaches contracts all the time, Your Honor, but that hasn't been the case or the experience of the state. The state often has much business and enters into many contracts, and it has not been a problem.
Well, this is not a question of whether the state should pay. This is a question of are we ever going to resolve this dispute and how? And the legislature is never going to resolve this dispute. All they're ever going to do is send you back to the courts to resolve it, right? That's the most they'll do. They're not going to hold a hearing on whether the state should lose this case.
No, Your Honor. They will have a determination of whether or not they should grant permission to sue.
So why shouldn't that go forward?
Because, Your Honor, if there really are equitable circumstances that warrant being able to sue, those can be presented to the legislature. If it strikes a particular court that it is such an inequitable circumstance that this party really should be able to sue the state, the legislature should make that policy decision, and they'll reach the same decision as the court should and permit that claimant to sue the state.
Let me ask you, there's been a trend in the courts of appeals, obviously, recently, to apply the waiver by conduct exception. Couldn't we avoid all these dangers that you're talking about by drafting a narrow waiver by conduct exception? There have been some cases that have talked about requiring full performance and acceptance of performance. And if there's been full performance and there's been acceptance of performance by the state, why shouldn't we craft a narrow waiver by conduct exception?
Your Honor, this case presents that exact example. The contract was completed, and they were paid not only the full contract price, several millions of dollars, they were also paid above and beyond that for additional work orders that they submitted to the TNRCC after that. However, they say we weren't paid the full amount of what it was worth for us to do that work. We should have been paid more. And that's the problem, Your Honor. That is a bona fide contract dispute. And it doesn't mean they weren't paid the full amount of the contract. They were. It means that they think that they deserve more. and that's not something that the court should look into.
But if it's a bona fide contract dispute, as you just said, why shouldn't it go to court? But some court's going to have to decide it someday.
Your Honor, after it goes through 2260, we think there will be a recommendation for the ALJ. That's what the legislature set up. Then there can be legislative consent to sue, and they can do it that way.
Is it fair to say, though, that after this court's decision, federal sign, the legislature got nervous about people's willingness to do business with it and created this administrative scheme to give the appearance that they will in advance agree that they should be bound by contract? Is that a fair reading of what the legislature's been doing?
Your Honor, I think you sent a message in federal sign to the legislature, and we believe in part that is the reason they enacted Chapter 2260.
Well, actually, I didn't send the message. others gave them that message. It seems to me the legislature got nervous about what that really meant for their contracts. There's another issue in this case, which is the party that was given the authority by the legislature to contract also contracted to go to court to resolve disputes. Is that a different twist in this rather than just simply by conduct? Is this a little bit different twist in this case?
You're referring to the contract clause, Your Honor.
Right.
We do not believe that there can be a contractual waiver of the state's immunity from suit. We believe that in Little Text, the court said apart from a special statute, or unless there's legislative consent, you have to go to Chapter 107 for breach of contract claims. And this court in Dalmat implicitly rejected that argument because in the terms of that contract, it stated prior to litigation between the owner and the contractor, the language of that contract itself contemplated that there may be future litigation. Nevertheless, this court said that there was no jurisdiction. And this very argument has been expressly rejected by federal courts. In Presidential Gardens, the plaintiffs tried to hold the United States liable for reaching a settlement agreement. In the terms of the settlement agreement, it said we agree to be bound and agree to submit to jurisdiction of a federal district court. Nevertheless, they said it's a well-settled principle, the Second Circuit said it's a well-settled principle of sovereign immunity, that the waiver of the United States can only be waived by congressional enactment.
What if the congressional enactment does, in this case, gives authority to the executive director on behalf of the commission to negotiate the contract?
You're talking about the thing that was...
In the Water Code Section 5.229, the executive director on behalf of the commission may negotiate and with the consent of the commission enter into contracts or agreements with states and political subdivisions, etc. Does that... So you're saying that the legislature gave the right to contract, but not the ability for parties entering into that contract to resolve disputes about that contract in court?
The legislature did not enact a clear and unambiguous waiver of the state's immunity from suit. In federal sign and in other courts, the right to contract, and even the statutory right to contract, is not a waiver of the state's immunity from suit.
How do you distinguish the Potawatomi Nations case?
Your Honor, I also happen to be counsel of record in Potawatomi, and we've made it very clear to the court during oral argument. There was a question from the justice that said, would this clause waive the state sovereign immunity for 11th Amendment if it were a state instead of a tribe? Well, Indian tribe waiver of immunity is a matter of federal law. It's well established by statute and federal law that they can waive it either by congressional abrogation or by agreeing in the terms of a contract to waive their immunity. And Mr. Coleman, the former Solicitor General, said, I believe not for a couple of different reasons. First of all, the standards that the states have set for waiving their own immunity are matters of state law. And the states have adopted a variety of standards, so one can't speak for a uniform standard of waiver with respect to state sovereignty.
So there's a congressional enactment that permits tribes to waive through their contract sovereign immunity.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We cited in the brief. That's 25 U.S.C. Section 81.
And that's an express waiver of sovereign immunity. It's not simply the authority of the tribe to contract generally.
But it also is a matter of federal law. The courts have held that there are two ways, unlike this court, which has always said it's a matter for the legislature and deferred. They say not only can Congress abrogate it in the statute, but also as a matter of federal Indian autonomy, they should be permitted as a tribe to waive their own immunity in the terms of a contract.
So the state ought to be able in order to make its contracts binding, the state ought to be able in its contracts to waive its immunity.
We think not, Your Honor. We think there are good reasons for the distinction between state immunity and tribal immunity. When one deals with the state, if one wanted to, you could build into your contract price the contingency that there might be some kind of problem, and you may not be able to go to court. But at least you know you are dealing with the state. Many tribal businesses, sometimes they're running their gas station, but sometimes they're A&M gas station. You may not know that you're dealing with a tribal entity. And therefore, some third party that's contracting with that person doesn't know that he needs to get a waiver of immunity from the tribe. And we think that that protection is necessary for the citizens. And that's why we intervened in that case and filed an amicus brief.
Let me ask you, a statement's been made that the legislature sent a message in enacting 2260. It seems that they've sent a message back now in amending it. What do you think the purpose of them accepting contracts like this one was? I mean, if they wanted to invade this field and take over and make these decisions, they could have easily done it under our decision. Why would they then go back and make an amendment that accepts this contract? What message are we to get from that?
Your Honor, there were many contracts that fell in some kind of no man's land with respect to the Chapter 2260. Most of them were these older contracts. Your Honor, one of the things that the legislation did was make clear that even if you had not complied with if you had not complied with the provisions of Chapter 2260, you could still go to the legislature. This court in Little Tech said it was a precursor, that you had to go to 2260 before 107. The legislature here said you can go directly to 107, and in fact, old contracts, that's what you should do.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Sadler will present argument from the respondent.
Good morning. May I proceed?
You may.
Mr. Sadler.
Yes, sir.
The state says in its brief, reply brief, that, quote, I.T. Davy admits that the court refused to adopt the what court mean this court adopt the waiver by conduct exception to sovereign immunity in general services versus Little Texas. Do you agree with that?
I do not agree with that statement at all.
Okay. The next question is, because of the amendment, do your first two issues become moot?
I think that is correct, Your Honor. The parties have expended considerable time and resources briefing an issue, and in fairness to my colleague, they briefed an issue which, while this case was in the pipeline, the legislature rendered moot by amending the statute.
On the other side, the court's questions indicates that the question of waiver by contract is still an issue. But your issues don't really cover that. You argue mostly about the third, fourth, and fifth issues that you raised in your responsive brief in the merits.
Your Honor, our most important issues are waiver by contract, declaratory judgment, and we certainly think we fit within any permutation of any waiver by conduct exception that any court of appeals has approved prior to Little Texas.
You said waiver by contract?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you arguing that by merely contracting here in your case that the state waived its immunity?
Absolutely not. We are relying on Article 11 of the contract, which, very importantly, and I want to stress this right now, this was not an accidental boilerplate provision that found its way into our agreement. We provided this morning as a handout a copy of the Code of Federal Regulations that was in effect at the time our contract was negotiated. The way this remedies clause got into our contract is very simple. TNRCC went to the federal government, the EPA, and said, help us clean up this big toxic waste site. Give us federal money. And the EPA agreed. And the EPA said, all right, here is the money, but here are some strings attached to the money. And one very important string is you, the state, have to include in your contracts with the people who are going to do the work certain contractual provisions. And the very provision that we are relying on, Article 11 in our contract, is stated almost verbatim in the CFR, the remedies provision. So there is really a fundamentally important way that this provision got into our contract. The TNRCC went to the federal government, got money, and in return had to promise the federal government that they would put this provision in our contract. They did that. And now, 10 years later, after getting the federal money, after getting all of our work, they don't want to live up to this particular provision. And so that is a very unique circumstance that we say constitutes a waiver of the state's right to assert sovereign immunity in this case.
Because do you have any cases that interpret this or a similar clause in the CFR?
Your Honor, I do not have any cases I could offer at this time. I would be happy with the court's leave to provide some short supplemental brief on that issue.
You can always file a supplemental brief.
But I have to be candid.
You don't have any third or any outside source that says that this provision trumps a state's normal sovereign immunity rules.
Well, no, Your Honor, but what we do have is a very well-established body of law by the United States Supreme Court that says federal regulations do, in fact, trump state law if the state law conflicts with or frustrates the purpose of the federal regulation. Now, here's the unusual circumstance in our case. This is not a situation where the state refused to put the contract provision in that the CFR said had to go in. They put it in. The twist is now they don't want to live up to it. So in that sense, their conduct now does, I would absolutely say, frustrate and conflict with the purpose of 40 CFR.
The conflict would have to be very, very close. All of this really says is that they can resolve it in a court of competent jurisdiction. I'm sure the state's argument is they can still do that as long as they go through the proper channels. So this is not such a direct conflict that it would preempt any sort of...
Well, and I don't, again, I'm not saying that they have refused to put that in. What they're refusing to do is to honor it and to live by it. The argument they make very succinctly is, number one, this is only a venue provision. Well, I think on its face that argument won't wash. Second, they say, well, there is no court of competent jurisdiction. We agreed we would submit our dispute to a court of competent jurisdiction, but right in their brief to this court, they say, you know what, there isn't one. And I don't think that's a very sound position for them to take, because what it says is you've got to strip that word out of the contract and add some new words into
it. Well, but all they're saying is you have to go through the proper channels, and if the legislature gives consent, there will be a court of competent jurisdiction.
I understand clearly that is what they are saying. What we are saying is by going to the federal government, getting the money in the way they did, complying with the regulations, putting this in our contract, binding themselves to that, that they cannot now repudiate this provision.
Well, let's talk real quick about waiver by conduct.
Yes, sir.
If we were to adopt some formulation of waiver by conduct, I know that the courts of appeals have made some recognition of that doctrine, and some have narrowed it very much, as I articulated before, full performance, full acceptance. But is that a bit simplistic? Are we always going to be able to tell when there's been full performance and full acceptance? Is that always going to be a sort of a morass for the courts to determine whether it's happened on a case-by-case basis?
I have to tell you, it can be. It's not in this case, because it's conceded everywhere that there was full performance. But depending upon how you define
full
performance...
Well, exactly. I mean, the state says just the opposite, that there was full performance and the contract was lived up to and paid, and we're in that morass right now.
I understand. If Your Honor is talking about how to craft a broader waiver by conduct rule that would apply not only to this case but perhaps to others, you're going to have to recognize the fact that full performance is going to depend on the facts and circumstances of each case. I'd be less than candid if I told you otherwise. But we're here now in this case where that is not an issue. Full performance is not an issue.
Let's say that it were. What do you do? I mean, who makes that determination? I guess the court does, or does the jury make that determination?
Well,
do you
Your
have
Honor,
a trial on whether the conduct's been, the waiver by conduct applies, and then you go into phase two where you, how does it work?
Let me make a suggestion. I believe there is case law to support the idea that in determining at the trial court level a plea to the jurisdiction, it is appropriate for the trial court to hear evidence. And I believe a rule perhaps could be crafted where the burden would be on the person bringing the case to establish jurisdiction by some, by a prima facie case, by preponderance, by some legally definable standard to the satisfaction of the trial court at an early stage, perhaps with limits, severe limits, or limits on no discovery whatsoever. But I believe that there are mechanisms in place to deal with the fact that if you're going to go with something called full and complete performance, that there's going to be some litigation over yes, it was, no, it wasn't. But I don't think we have to reinvent the wheel. I think there is already case law that says a court can hear some level of evidence in response to a plea to the jurisdiction. The waiver by
the state argues that you can't have a contractual waiver of federal immunity. Do you agree with that?
Well, I do not agree that the with what they say. What they say is the highest officials of the TNRCC had no authority to agree to this contract provision. That's the precise statement, I think, almost a quote out of the brief. And I don't think that's correct. I do not think that's correct under the facts and the law. They didn't cite you any Texas law on that. Now, they went out and found a Second Circuit case on that. But those are very different facts and circumstance. The reference that was made to Dalmac a minute ago, that's a very different fact and circumstance. Again, going back to how this contract provision made its way in here, this is something the state bargained for at two levels. First with the federal government to get the money, and then with us. And
well, my question is, a clause like this in a federal contract would not waive federal immunity.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I'm not sure the answer to that question. I think under state law, it does not and should not, and there's no state authority that says that this is an invalid clause because the highest officials of the TNRCC had no authority to negotiate it. And let me speak to that just a moment because it raises an issue not addressed by the state. I think even Federal Sign recognized that in circumstances where state officials act without authority, that there is a remedy, and sovereign immunity is not a bar to that.
But the remedy is against the ultra-virus official, not the entity. That's clear, isn't it?
You're absolutely, it's not considered a suit against the state, but there is a legal remedy. Well, here that's a complete, that argument from their side
but
is a complete.
Also, we said that those officials don't get the benefit of sovereign immunity under those circumstances.
That's also correct.
Which is a pretty big difference in what your argument is.
Well, my argument here is that for them to take the position that these officials had no authority at two levels to negotiate this particular clause in the contract is a self-fulfilling.
Let me ask you a question about that argument. Of
yes, sir.
Federal. Are you arguing that that clause is in there because of federal regulations, therefore, because it's a federal reg, it preempts state sovereign immunity law?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you argue that in your brief?
No, Your Honor, we did not submit the preemption.
Is it preemption a theory that has to be pled and argued? It just doesn't come up the first time in front of this court, does it?
No, you're absolutely correct. And my position on that is, does their conduct now conflict with the regulation? Yes, I think it does. But I think the preemption is a much narrower issue, and you don't really get to that if, in fact, they comply with the regulation.
I'm getting lost because most of the comments are being made directly affect the waiver by conduct, but most of the briefing has to do with two sections of the Water Code, your declaratory judgment claim, and the 2260 matter. And most of what I'm hearing this morning is completely outside the scope of that briefing.
No, Your Honor, let me point, if I can, your attention to, I will blame the legislature for this. Let me just say it that way. The whole issue of waiver by contract in the briefing got wrapped up into the issue of does 2260 apply or not. If you look in their brief on the merits, they say these guys cannot have a contractual waiver because they are pushed out of court by 2260.
That argument, if I understand your response should be made under your issue four, the Declaratory Judgment Act discussion. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. We made very succinctly and clearly in our response brief on the merits that we had a contractual waiver. We made that argument succinctly. We cited the case that concerns our...
But you're asking us, as part of your Declaratory Judgment Act suit, to construe this contract in that manner. Is that correct?
What I'm asking the court to do on our declaratory judgment claim is to allow us to proceed with the bona fide contractual dispute that's been conceded. This is not they do concede quite plainly that under the Leeper case there is a waiver of both immunity from suit and liability under the Declaratory Judgment Act.
Would they respond to your Leeper case with State of Texas versus Operating Contractors and say that all that you have here is an artful pleading of a declaratory judgment to get around the sovereign immunity doctrine when all that you're really asking for is to be paid $7 million? That's their answer.
Yes, and may I respond to that now quite directly? We do have, and we will stand on our pleadings, our First Amendment petition that's in the record. Our Declaratory Judgment Act claim is a separate, independent, standalone claim from the other claims in our pleading. And let me tell you why. It is absolutely correct that the core of this dispute between the parties turns on the interpretation and construction of a couple of key provisions in the contract. The whole issue, what we're fighting about, is we claim we did some extra work above and beyond the contract and they still owe us money. Our basis for saying that is, look, under the contract provides a mechanism for resolving this. It says you, the contractor, if you find site conditions when you go out there and do the work that are materially different, you can apply for an equitable adjustment, more money. Also, if you go out there and find that our TNRCC's specifications were, quote unquote, defective, you can apply for an equitable adjustment. That's precisely what we've been telling them since 1992. You gave us defective specs. You gave us different
site conditions. But all this argument does is go to the issue of the dispute on why you weren't paid. But the issue we have before us today is how can you get into court in the face of sovereign immunity? And their response is, you can't get into court by calling it a declaratory judgment because it's merely a dispute over payment or not. You can't use a Declaratory Judgment Act cause to evade sovereign immunity, and that's what State versus Contracting people
say. That is what they're saying, and what I'm saying is we have a separate, independent, standalone, could have brought it by itself, deck action that's doing exactly what the deck statute says. And let me quote from the statute. We are authorized to seek a suit to declare relief whether or not other relief is or could be claimed. That's 37.003A. That's exactly what we're doing. We are authorized to maintain that suit without legislative permission. That's what Leeper holds. We're even entitled to a jury trial if construction or interpretation of these disputed terms of the contract require resolution of some fact issue. That's right out of the statute. And most importantly, of course, and this is where Leeper came down, we must join the TNRCC. There's no other part of this contract.
But this is where, aren't you, even if you got a declaratory judgment that says yes, if there were these conditions, or yes, if you were given wrong specifications, you do have the right to make an equitable adjustment claim. That still wouldn't get you anywhere because you want determination that yes, you were in fact given bad specifications, or yes, in fact, the conditions were different. And you can't get that in Declaratory Judgment Act, can you?
I think we can, because right now the parties are at complete loggerheads over the meaning of materially different site conditions and what defective means. I will point out, and this is a contract I didn't draft, so I can criticize it, those two key terms are not defined in the contract. Defective specification is not defined. Materially different site conditions is defined in a completely circular way. It's defined as things that you find that are different from what you expect in a material way. Well, that's the core of the dispute, and I think this is just like any other contract dispute where the parties have a different interpretation over specific key terms. We're entitled to go to court and have a judge declare, this is what this term means.
But wouldn't that swallow up all our prior jurisdiction on sovereign immunity? Because every contract line, you would go and say, I want a declaratory judgment that says, yes, the state is in breach, and you would get everything up to the award of damages.
And let me be very clear. There was a case cited, the Jones Paving case, that was cited in their brief, where that's exactly what Jones Paving did. They simply said, please declare that we're entitled to money. And that's not all of what we're asking. We have a separate, pure declaratory judgment claim that says the parties are unsure what this contract says. Judge, tell us what this contract says. And let me point out right here, they have never in 10 years taken the position that if it were determined that there were materially different site conditions and there were defective specs, that they wouldn't make the equitable adjustment. They've never said that. What they've said is they don't agree on the front end that there were different site conditions within the meaning of the contract, or that they gave us defective specs within the meaning of the contract. So that is a separate and independent dispute that can be litigated, should be litigated, and can only be litigated, I would say, under the declaratory judgment.
But then if they don't pay, you've still got to go back some way or another and get a breach of contract action against the state.
I have to concede, if we litigated that and we got a declaratory judgment that says material conditions means this, defective means that, the work you did was because of that, we at that point would go to the state and say, all right, under the contract, make the equitable adjustment that is specifically provided for.
Mr. Sadler, before your time runs out, can you tell me what is the clear and express language outside of this contract dispute that we've been talking about? What is the clear and express language by the legislature that you contend shows a waiver of sovereign immunity? What statute, what language waives expressly the state's sovereign immunity?
What I would point to, Your Honor, and with specific regard to your question, all I can point to is the legislature specifically authorized the PNRCC executive director in consultation with the commission to execute contracts for the purpose of carrying out their work. And everything they did in this regard in going to get the federal money to do this work, they did. And that is the authority that I would point to. And I don't believe what they did was ultra virus or outside the scope of their authority. Quite to the contrary, I believe it was with them.
Has IT Davy been to the legislature?
No, Your
Honor. I have one quick question.
Yes.
I think it's fair to say we have no briefing from you on waiver by conduct. I understand why, but we just don't have it. I mean, it's sort of an odd circumstance, but we don't have it.
And we would be, I think we would be happy to submit whatever supplemental briefing on that broader issue the court would find appropriate. And again,
well, more quickly, just for purposes here, before you sit down, is there a particular Court of Appeals case that you would rely on for our formulation of that doctrine? We have not heard from you how you would craft a waiver by conduct exception.
And let me answer that quickly in two parts. I think the Court of Appeals, as I recall it, the Court of Appeals, San Antonio, Austin, and Houston followed or interpreted federal sign to authorize this waiver by conduct. I think they all tried to adhere to some concept of a full or complete performance. And I certainly agree with that formulation of the rule. And again, I apologize if this isn't clear from our brief, but I mean, we certainly litigated through the Court of Appeals saying, yes, waiver by conduct is the appropriate rule. We like the opinion that we got out of the Austin Court of Appeals on that. But to answer your question, Your Honor, the formulation, if there's going to be a broad waiver by conduct rule as distinct from this contract issue, I can only at this time offer you the standard of if the state accepts complete performance under a contract and then refuses to abide by the terms of the contract, that would constitute the waiver.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Thompson, what about Lieber, which said the Act does contemplate meaning declaratory judgment act, that the government entities may be indeed must be joined in suits to construe their legislative pronouncements.
Yes, Your Honor. We think that LIPR did two things. It waived immunity of liability for attorney's fees and immunity of suit for statutory construction and two true declaratory judgment claims. But we also believe from the Hayden versus Dogden case and everything else, this court's jurisprudence, you can't characterize what is essentially a breach of contract claim where you want money damages from the state as a declaratory judgment action in order to sidestep the immunity.
How do you have a declaratory action involving interpretation of contract that does not have an economic impact?
It may have an economic impact, Your Honor, but there can also be one as to whether or not there's coverage. I think that's a common issue that's done by declaratory judgment. But
that simply is segregating out the claims. You want the money. The question is there coverage? And if you lose on the coverage, you don't get the money. It's the same thing in this case. If this is a material change or a defective deal, you get the money. If it's not, you don't.
We believe, Your Honor, that if your goal is to take the declaratory judgment action and turn it in to a claim for monetary damages, then essentially you're taking a breach of contract claim and trying to characterize it.
But why isn't a coverage question a contract claim in a breach?
I'm sorry?
Why isn't a coverage question, which is the example you gave, a contract dispute?
It is a contract dispute,
but it's going to lead to money.
But the question is whether or not an action should be taken before the ultimate trial.
But nobody spends money for declaratory action to interpret a contract if they don't think it's going to have some sort of economic impact. It's going to mean something monetarily.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's why we think that it can't be done that way here. We think that the primary goal is to get money from the state for a breach of contract claim.
With Mr. Sadler, his explanation of how that contractual provision got into the contract, is that your understanding as well?
Your Honor, I received that this morning for the very first time. I do understand that that is the exact language that is in the contract.
Was there a negotiation between the federal government and the state that required inclusion of this contract?
I cannot answer that question this morning, Your Honor. All I can say is that even if it were, we believe that the federal government doesn't have the authority to waive the state's immunity in state court under Alden versus Maine. Justice Hankison, I'd like to give one more shot to your question, if I might. We believe there are lots of problems with trying to craft a narrow waiver by conduct exception. We believe one is that, in this case, it was the head of the TNRCC who negotiated the contract. But it also could be a low-level employee that could do some sort of contract, agree to it, take some action, accept some performance, and thereby waive the state's immunity on a huge contract. And we don't think that that should be the case. Second, it could also involve a legislative tug of war, exactly what we discussed in the Little Tex argument. If the legislature crafts something that the court doesn't like, the court can amend it, and then they'll have to go back to the legislature. And if they like what you did versus not, we believe that that decision should still stay in the legislature. And finally, we think that it is such a fact-based exception that by the time you figure out whether or not there was substantial performance or whether or not there had been equitable conduct or an inequitable result, you basically required the state to try the merits of a case before you can make a jurisdictional determination. And that deprives the states of some of the primary benefits of immunity from suit, which is not to be subject to the attendant burdens of litigation.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first case. The court will now take a brief recess.